Welcome to the Cleveland Public Library's Sports Research Center and our conversation with former Browns coach Sam Ritigliano. Sam coached the Browns from 1978 until mid-season of 1984 when he was fired and replaced by Marty Schottenheimer. But Sam remains one of the most revered sports heroes here in Cleveland, and the 1980 season that he orchestrated remains the most memorable in Cleveland sports history. The 1980 Browns acquired the nickname Cardiac Kids because of last-minute heroics. The Browns won 2 games by 1 point and 3 games by 3 points. Every game, win or lose, seemed to be a nail-biter. Quarterback Brian Sipe was voted Pro Football's most valuable player for running Sam's exciting pass-oriented offense. The Browns entered the playoffs as the favorite to win the Super Bowl, but their playoff season ended early on January 4th, 1981, with a shocking loss to the Oakland Raiders on an interception in the end zone on a play called, infamously, Red Right 88. After Cleveland, Sam coached for more than 10 years at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia, and overseas in NFL Europe. But he never left his home in Waite Hill on Cleveland's east side. Sam and his wife Barbara still live there. We sat down with Sam on November 1st, 2012. Sam, welcome to the Cleveland Public Library Archives.
I think I'm an archive myself.
You are. We're doing this in October, Halloween night, in 2012.
Right.
And as people watch this maybe 50 years from now, they'll say, boy, they're looking pretty good for being 130. Anyway, Sam Ritigliano, one of the most revered football coach in Cleveland history.
Well, that's saying a lot. Now talking about Paul Brown and Blanton Kaya. It's people say that, and I'm just so happy to be here. You know, we moved a lot of times, and it was kind of nice that I left the Browns, that we kept a home in Waite Hill, and they were only 19 minutes from downtown and have 12 acres, and it was kind of a payback, but because my wife really liked it here, and for the first time in my career, we were able to go back and stay someplace, and it's going to be forever.
You made 19 moves, you said once. And I have in front of me a list of all these places that you coached. Let me put my glasses on. Okay, you come out of Erasmus Hall High School in Brooklyn.
Right.
Who else? What other famous
Erasmus
people?
Hall High School was Sid Luckman, uh-huh. Al Davis, Bob Tisch, Jerry Weinsdorf, who owns the Bulls and the White Sox. It was Barbara Streisand, Neil Diamond. Bill Cunningham, Doug Moe. It was the oldest high school in the country. And there were quite a few celebrities other than just sports celebrities. But as a matter of fact, we had a reunion, had a lot of reunions in New York. We had a reunion with Bob Tisch and myself and Jerry Reinsdorf and Sid Luckman and Al Davis. And they took a picture and Al Davis sent it. And it's now, thank goodness, it's in the Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio.
How nice.
It's great.
So you were an all-scholastic wide receiver on a city championship football team. Was that a huge high school, by the way?
We had 6,000 students, triple session.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a
triple
big school.
Sessions.
Triple session. They came from 7 to 12 and from 10 to 2 and from about 2 to 4 or 6. They just couldn't handle every kid, and so they had triple session.
Well, you must have crammed your classes in very tight.
Right, yeah, it was very interesting. You know, as I went on to coach myself in high school, I came back, as soon as I got out of college, I came back and went to Lafayette High School, which was a high school where Sandy Koufax went to school there.
Really?
Yep.
So anyway, you then played at East Central Junior College in Decatur, Mississippi,
right.
University of Tennessee, Tulsa. Then later on, you got your master's from Columbia.
Right.
You were an assistant coach at Lafayette High School in Brooklyn, in Greenwich, Connecticut High School, and in Chappaqua. Chappaqua in New York.
That's where the former president, Clinton, lives. It's in Westchester County.
Oh, is that a very fancy neighborhood?
Very fancy. I didn't live there, though.
Yeah.
Didn't get paid to live there.
So then all these colleges you coached at, University of Connecticut, Maryland, then you went to the Denver Broncos, the New England Patriots, the Jets, New Orleans. And in December of 1977.
Right.
You're hired as the new coach of the Cleveland Browns.
Right.
How did Art Modell find you? You'd been an assistant coach all these places.
Right. Well, you know, we both came from Brooklyn, but that wasn't the reason why. But Peter Hadhazy was the assistant general manager at the New England Patriots, and I was there with him for 3 years. And then, of course, I went to the Jets, and then I went to the Saints with Hank Stram. And then Peter called me in Game 15, where, unfortunately, Archie Manning had played only in 6 games in the 2 years that we were there, and it looked like we were going to get fired. And Peter called me one Thursday night before our 15th game and said, Sam, if you don't blow the interview, I think you're going to get the job with the Cleveland Browns, and we're going to call the president for permission to talk to you on Monday. And so I said to myself, wow. And anyway, we ended up in that 15th game playing Tampa, where they had lost, I think, 27 straight games. And we lost that game that night. And I'm driving back to Covington, Louisiana, across a bridge with my wife saying, my gosh, I was going to take you now to a nice restaurant in New Orleans. We got to go to McDonald's, because there's no way they're going to hire me after we lost. Anyway, the following week went by, and we got to Thursday, and Peter Hadhazy called me. I had one more game to do with the Atlanta Falcons. He said, we've talked for permission to talk to you, and Monday you're going to come into Cleveland. There's a guy going to pick you up at the airport, bring you out to Art Modell's house, and I interviewed for about 3 days here, and I thought everything went extremely well. And then I was in New Orleans on Christmas Eve, and I got a call from Art Modell. He said, I wanted to speak to the new head coach of the Cleveland Browns, Sam Rutigliano, and it was just great.
That was on Christmas Eve?
Christmas Eve, right.
Wow.
It was great, yeah.
And were they generally happy years here?
Oh, yeah. I think that, the one thing that I learned from particularly the four coaches who I coached with in the NFL, it's a lot of things to be learned, you know, and I wrote a lot of things down and so forth. But the one thing that I learned more than anything else in being a head coach, because, you know, assistant coaches make suggestions, head coaches make decisions, is to have selective amnesia. You know, when there were so many great things that happened here for me, you know, and as I look back on Paul Brown, and I look back on Blanton Kaya, and the great heritage, and you know, the beginning of the National Football League with those two men, it was really a privilege and an honor. I was the fifth head coach of the Cleveland Browns. Doug Deacon was the third offensive left tackle for the Cleveland Browns. So there were so many wonderful things. And then, you know, when I got fired, the selective amnesia set in. And you know, to be very honest, I stopped for a couple of years and worked in television and realized I really wanted to go back. But I didn't want to go back, and I had a couple of opportunities to go back. I didn't want to go back, and I took a job at Liberty University, and it had such an impact on my son and my two daughters and my family. And then I retired, and 3 hours later, Jack Bicknell, a former head coach of Boston College, said, he works in NFL Europe, and I took a job in NFL Europe, and I coached with my wife being there in Barcelona, Spain, in Holland, and in Hamburg, Germany, which was absolutely unbelievable. Then Jim Donovan called me in Germany and said, we're going to do a show on Channel 3, and we would love to have you as part of it with Doug Deacon and Tony Grossi. Came back back, and ever since then, I've been working in television, covering the Browns, some in radio, and having opportunities to be around people like you and at this library, which is just unbelievable, and really living it the way someone normally should live it, because not as a coach, because when I was the coach, I mean, it was 24/7, and my family hardly ever saw me, let alone had a chance to do things.
When you were at Liberty, you came back here and you maintained your house in Waite Hill.
Right.
You continued living in the off season here.
Right.
How could you fit that in with a scholarship football program?
Well, basically, my wife, we came back for the holidays, and then my wife came back and stayed the entire summer, and I really was there, 10 and a half to 11 months out of the year, because of what you just said, because of recruiting and all the things that go on right now in college, where you're really working all year round.
Let's go back now to the glory year,
right,
of 1980.
Wow.
The cardiac kids.
Right.
Let's delve into that a little bit, and before we're done, I'm going to ask you for your views on Cleveland, why you stayed.
Right.
Let's talk about 1980.
Mm-hmm.
What a season. This town was alive.
Right.
It was electric. It was magic. Now, you were working 24/7. Were you ever able to step back and smell those roses?
You know, it's really a good question, because, we opened up that season in Boston and lost to the Patriots. Came back on a Monday night and lost 14-7 to the Houston Oilers. And I remember going up to Art's office and Peter Hadhazy, the general manager, because we finished so strong in 1979. I was coach of the year, and everybody had really, really high hopes for 1980. And as I said to the players in training camp, if we're going to do it, we got to get it done through Pittsburgh. And
What was Art like when you'd go up to his office after a loss?
We went out to dinner in Roman's Gardens in Little Italy, on all home games, the ones that we won and the ones that we lost. The ones that we won were a lot of fun. The ones that we lost, I always managed during the course of the meal to give my wife a little bit of a signal like this in the sting that we need to go home, because it's not very pleasant. So I enjoyed the ones that we won because he did. The ones that we lost were not very much fun. And fortunately, we won a lot more than we lost. It was interesting. He really, I'm sure we'll get to it, when we beat Cincinnati in 1980 there and we came back to Cleveland as the divisional champ and going to the playoffs for the first time, I think, then at that point in 10 years.
Was Art a difficult man to work for?
No, he was had a great sense of humor. And I really enjoyed every moment, even though I thought at times there were people that were telling him things that he just wanted to hear, rather than have somebody to do it the right way and be able to kick the gorilla in the ankle and let him know really what. And the only one that could do that would be the head coach, because between the owner and the head coach, there lies, all the pressure. There lies everything, that decisions that need to be made and so forth and so on. And as I look back at the 7 years and the opportunity to come to Cleveland, it was great. And now that I'm here with you, years later in 2012, and I'm here and my two daughters are here and some of my grandson is here, and we're living in Waite Hill, and I have an opportunity to be part of the Browns in television and radio, I couldn't be happier with the decision that both my wife and I made to stay here. And now we've been here since 1978.
The feeling was euphoric in 1980.
Yeah.
As we went into the playoffs. And the first game was against the wild card team, the Oakland Raiders.
Right. Who eventually went on to beat Philadelphia
win
it all.
A wild card team
right.
wins. Everybody, we all thought this is the Browns' year. Brian Sipe had a dream season.
MVP.
As Yes, yes.
Broke, I think, every record that every quarterback, including Otto Graham, made in the history of the Cleveland Browns.
They wrote a song about the Browns, right, the 12 days of a Browns Christmas.
And we still get it. still get it.
And
it was great.
And so now, that was the coldest we have ever been at a football game.
You know, last week when we were watching them play San Diego, and I met some people and talked to people who had been at that game in 1980, said it wasn't even close. I mean, we did a show that night with Reggie Rucker and, you know, all of us. You know, I was not normal for about a week later, you know, in terms of the coldness and you saw the players with icicles in their nose and hands scraped, you know, and blood coming out and frozen. It was unbelievable.
For young fans who are listening to this conversation now, we've got to set the stage. The temperature had to be 10 below zero. More. Wind chill factor was like 30 below.
Yeah, right.
On this playoff game at the old stadium, there was the field was frozen solid.
Right.
You eschewed a field goal in that final drive. What was the final score? 14-12
Final score was 14-12
Okay, and Browns' final possession. You're marching. You're driving. Mike Pruitt had a big run in that drive. Get down in what?
Get down to about the 19-yard line, and we would. Yeah, if you remember correctly, the Raiders had fourth and less than an inch. And if they could have kicked the field goal and got field goal and gone up by five, which means we had to have a touchdown to win. Well, Dick Ambrose made a great play, and we stopped them, and we drove the length of the field, got to the 19-yard line, and there was about less than a minute to play. And I said to Brian Sipe, I said, look, you know, we've missed two field goals and an extra point or two already.
And that was because of the wind?
The wind,
the
everything.
Cold,
it was the open end of the field. And I said, you know, this thing is not, it's not a kick that we know we can get because we already experienced it. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to run the ball on first down, run the clock. We're going to run the ball on third down, run the clock, and have the Raiders either give up their last timeout or run the clock down. But on second down, we got to try to win the game. And we're going to go with red right 88. Red right 88 meant that Ozzie Newsome was going to run a post route. Reggie Rucker was going to run a post route. And we felt that everything in pro football is matchups. Dave Logan, 6'5", on a matchup of a corner, I don't even remember his name, about 5'11", a 6 foot, running across the field, and with Ozzie and Reggie running up the opposite direction and into the posts. And so Brian dropped back, and here comes Dave Logan the next day on film. He's up, he's 3 or 4 yards ahead of this guy, sitting in the end zone for the dink, and we're going to go up and win the game. And he saw Ozzie open, you know, and here's a guy who was the MVP that year. Ozzie was a key factor in what we were trying to do in a passing game, and the ball sailed, and Mike Davis intercepted it, and that was Red Right 88. And, you know, even to this point, it was the right thing to do. A lot of people, you know, talk about it now. But, I mean, I'm going back to what I said to you right from the beginning, selective amnesia. When I made decisions and I had thought them out the way I did with Brian, and not that he made the decision, but he was the quarterback, and he believed in it himself, and the rest is history. And I'm not too sure that Don Cockcroft could have written a book over 662 pages that's unbelievable, and he thought it was going to be Red Right 88. He said, Don, it's not about Red Right 88. It's about the Cleveland Browns and the kind of season that they had that year and how the people responded to it. You know, it was unbelievable. And that's what I hold right now as I look back at it and years later. And, you know, and how great it was to come back here and to live here and to have a little part of what the Browns are doing now and trying to, you know, get back where they belong.
Now, you have watched this franchise from...
Right.
From the time Paul Brown got fired
right.
until now, well into the next millennium, as we're talking here in 2012. The Browns have had 13 seasons, and you've watched all of them, and it looked like there was no hope.
Right.
I'm sure that in the perspective of what happens after our conversation, so someday there will be hope. What do you think? What do you project?
Well, I think very frankly, that with all due respect, I really believe that Jim Haslam, who put $1 billion on the table, is not going to ride shotgun. I played with his father at the University of Tennessee in 1951, where we won the national championship. Not that that means anything, but he's been an integral part of that his business, The Pilot, where they have over 19,000 employees, and people don't realize. They think, well, you got to hire a president, you got to hire a general manager, then those two guys have to hire the coach. No, you have to have the owner involved, because the owner makes everybody accountable, and that's what he's going to do. We're going to go through some changes, I'm sure, at the end of this season, but I really believe now we have an owner that's going to be heavily involved, and I think it also helped him to go to Pittsburgh as a 12% owner and see, like, and study the Pittsburgh, where Chuck Noll and Bill Cowher were the only two coaches for 39 years. They won 470 games, and they went to 6 Super Bowls. And when Mike Tomlin took over, he went to, I think, 3 Super Bowls and won 2 of them. So they have the answer, and the answer is consistency confirms authenticity. And that's what he's going to bring to the table. And I don't know how the thing is going to work out. I like Pat Shermer very much, but I think there are going to be some changes, and they'll be made at the end of the year. And I think now the light at the end of the tunnel is not an oncoming train. It's a light there. And I think because of that, and if you look at the history of the NFL, and you look at ownership, and you look at who they choose to be their coaches, and who they choose to select their talent, that this guy is going to get that done. We've had too many presidents, too many general managers, too many coaches, too many players, and too many mistakes. I think we have won a little over 60 and a lot over 160 in 14 years. You know, we're on our 17th quarterback. Count the quarterbacks from Paul Brown to Bernie Kosar.
Well, we could on one hand.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly. That's why I feel that we're going to be okay.
Okay. Art Modell was a very involved president,
right,
owner. Is that good or bad? Can it be both? Can it be either?
Just as long as you have to be heavily involved, because I think you need that leadership. But as long as you have the ability to select men of ability, which we haven't done that in the past, as long as you're going to be very interesting to see now how he and Joe Boehner handle what I just said in terms of two things. One, the acquisition of talent, and two, to have the coaching staff that's going to get those people up to play the A game every single week. You're seeing teams, you know, especially like New England, with Bill Belichick doing that. They're winning every year, because everything that I said to you that was positive today about the Browns is going on in New England. And also, that the biggest thing of all, as I said before, would be Jim Haslam Jr. being able to spend the time with the Pittsburgh Steelers and see how well they did both those two things.
Who's the most interesting person you ever coached?
Well, the most interesting person I ever coached was obviously Brian Sipe. You know, he's a 13th round draft choice. We give up Paul Warfield to get Mike Phipps. You know, Paul was walking into the Hall of Fame when he left the Cleveland Browns. Then all of a sudden this guy comes in and takes over and breaks every record of every quarterback that ever played for the Cleveland Browns. And you and I both know what the list is. He was so hard. It's indefinable. You know, he thrived on pressure. As an example, Michael Jordan, 7th game, Chicago Bulls, down by 1 point, 7 seconds left to go. 4 guys have grapefruits in their esophagus, and Michael Jordan says, "Give me the ball." Sipe was like that every game that we played. He loved those last 2 or 3 minutes. And you can ask, you know, you can ask guys like Doug Deacon, who you know very well, and guys like Robert Jackson, who you know very well, guys like Greg Pruitt, who you know very well, you know, what he was like in the huddle. You know, Deacon said to me something very interesting when we were working together in television. We still are. I asked him, I said, what did you think of Mike Phipps? He said, they knew the first time Mike Phipps, they got in a huddle with Mike Phipps, he wasn't the guy. And if you ask him about Brian Sipe, he'll tell you one thing. He's a winner. He's a winner. And he, you know, you know, Brady's the 199th pick. Drew Brees was a second-round draft choice. Dan Fouts was a 64th pick in the draft. Dan Marino was the 32nd pick in the draft where they picked six quarterbacks. So, you know, nobody knows. Nobody knows. It's that intangible that you just, you know, I think that probably in the records as they stand, most number ones that were picked one and two, 50% of them were failures, maybe even 60%. I mean, Brady didn't even start at Michigan. And here he is now, I think, six Super Bowls, three of which he won. And and as good a coach as Belichick was, Drew Bledsoe got hurt. And Brady went in there. And then when the decision time came for him to put Drew Bledsoe back in there, he said no. And Drew Bledsoe went to Dallas and finished his season and look what he got right there. So it's kind of a crapshoot, too.
A quarterback is essential to winning in the NFL.
Oh, yeah. It's a more now more than ever, it's a quarterback-driven league. And, you know, after you have the owner, you have that the right owner, and you pick the right people, you got to have a quarterback if you're going to win in this league. And all I can tell you is just take a look at it in our time and this time now, and look at Rodgers and look at the Mannings, you know, and quarterbacks that are elite quarterbacks, Drew Brees, they're winning because of that.
When Bill Belichick fired Bernie Kosar, was Bernie finished?
No, he wasn't finished. I think Bill Belichick was here for 5 years, and I think Bill Belichick learned a lot here. And I think, you know, I think when he got fired and he went back to New York, and I think Parcells then was the head coach and was going to become the general manager of the New York Jets. And he said he wanted Bill Belichick to stay. And he said no, because he was going to go to New England as the head coach. And history repeats itself. And I really believe that guys like Eric Mangini, guys like Romeo Crennel, guys like Charlie Weiss, guys like that McDaniels kid who was at Denver, that Ed McMahon was great for Johnny Carson, but he wasn't Johnny Carson. So don't imitate. Be yourself. And I think when Belichick went to New England, he was Bill Belichick, and he proved it. And I think coaches make mistakes when they're on winning teams and they get an opportunity. Because I can say myself, you know, I was with Lou Saban, and I was with Chuck Fairbanks, and I was with Charlie Winner, but Eubank in New York, and I was with what's his name from the Kansas City Chiefs, Hank Stram, and I learned something from all of them. And all the things that I learned, I implemented when I first got the job here, but I never imitated them. I was going to be me, and if that wasn't good enough, I wasn't going to make it. I think that's really important.
One of your famous statements here, you said, I'm good for Cleveland. Now, what did you mean by that?
Well, you know, I guess, you know, it was kind of interesting because a lot of people, I got fired, you know, during the course of that statement, and a lot of people said, you know, come on, we're not interested in that. We're interested in winning. And I thought to myself, well, you know, maybe I said that and maybe I said it to myself and said it to my family, and now that I'm back, you know, and I'm here with you and all the different things that I have an opportunity to cherish, all the different things that I have opportunity for myself and my family to enjoy, I would say that I was.
will you save some lives with your inner circle?
Well, the inner circle.
And I wondered if that may be what you meant.
Well, big.
Without really saying the inner circle.
Well, I guess so, because of it was such a great program.
Oh, we must explain to our viewers, our listeners, that what the inner circle was.
Right.
It was several back then. That was the era of drugs, drug abuse.
Right.
And you had a drug problem on the Browns,
right,
and you created this inner circle, private group, to save these lives, and you did.
Yeah, Dr. Collins at the Cleveland Clinic, who I spoke to yesterday. We're involved in another program in the inner city right now with young kids about reading in the fourth grade. But we had 11 guys. I had a guy come in to my office and tell me that he lived in an apartment in Berea, and he had tried to commit suicide 2 weeks in a row. And my job then was to kind of just talk to them and then move them on to Dr. Collins. And then that person, and I said to the team what I was doing. I don't want anybody to tell me, you know, who you think is doing it. I want you to come. I want you to trust me as I will trust you that you'll be able to cure this disease while you're still playing. And that's what we did. Every single one of them made it back. And some of them, who I'm sure people think they know who they are, I just made a pledge that I would go to my grave before I would ever reveal any one of them, and they felt the same way. Some of them have come out and said, that they were involved in the program, but Art Modell had a lot to do with it because he paid for all of it, and all of them made it. All of them made it. And we're sad to say that, after I left, that Don Rogers died. And then Lilo Zeto with the Oakland Raiders, he died because of drug overdose.
Yes. And some relapsed, but
came
you
back.
Did your best to save them.
Right, exactly.
Many coaches would do that. They'll say, that's not my job. I'm a football coach.
And a lot of coaches said that.
Yes.
And a lot of coaches said, win. Don't worry about soul saving. But, you know, I told Art Modell that I know how important winning is, but I want you to know how I feel about helping those guys and also winning. I need to do both. I can't do one without the other. And he was very good about that. And of course, his son David was affected, and that made it a lot more. He was a lot more helpful because of that, and especially his wife, Pat. They visited with Dr. Collins at the clinic. And David got through and got well.
Yes,
which
he
was
did.
Great.
And I can remember he came out on television,
right,
on Channel 8,
right,
to say that he
what
had,
it did for him.
Right. Yes, yes.
That's great.
Yes.
That's great.
And I can remember calling Art to tell him, you should know that David is going to be on our air tonight at 6 o'clock.
Right.
And talking about his drug problems. And Art was shocked that David was going public with that.
Yeah. But you know where the real cure is, Dan? Helping others. By doing that, that night, he might have helped somebody that was listening in that had a problem and was a great Browns fan. I really believe that.
Out of all the things you did, how does that rank in great accomplishments?
Got to be number one.
Really?
Got to be number one. I mean, come on. 9 to 11 guys, lives are saved. I had a chance to speak to a group in Kalahari this year, and one of the players was there. And he's recovering, he's okay. And he got up and he said to that, when he introduced me, he said, that man saved my life.
Really?
Doesn't get any better than that.
Wow.
I mean, I would trade those 9-11 guys for 9 Super Bowls any day,
really?
Anytime. Yep.
Okay. That's your greatest success. What was your biggest disappointment?
Oh, probably the biggest disappointment. Biggest disappointment I would have to say in my life is in 1961. I was in a car accident and I lost my four and a half year old daughter.
Oh,
she
no.
was killed.
Oh,
yep.
No.
And my wife and I have fought through that for our entire lives.
Really?
And again, there's a place, Bobby DiGeronimo's son-in-law and daughter, after they lost a 3.5-year-old son with a viral infection at the Cleveland Clinic, it's called the Cornerstone of Hope. And I kind of work for them. And every time I have an opportunity, Dan, to talk to someone who lost a spouse or who lost a child and tell them my story. You know, I lead off with this. This guy's going to the gas chamber, and the attendant says, "Don't worry about it, it'll be over in 5 seconds." And the guy says, "How do you know?" And so I can say to them, "I know." And God has to be totally involved for you to be able to live the rest of your life. When you think about, you know, what would she have been like today? Who would she have married? How many grandkids would I have had? Then I stop. Then I stop with this. God didn't send me an email, but he told me that I can't bring her back. But I promise you that you can be with her forever. And so my wife and I look forward to that day. Wow.
Gee, yes, wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Then I guess that Red Right 88 certainly is that significant.
Amen.
Compared to those.
Selective amnesia.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a lot to be thankful for. A lot to be thankful for.
Is there anything you would do over differently? Do over again? Would you be a football coach again?
Oh, yeah, when I got out of college, I went back to New York, got a job in a high school there, and got my master's at Columbia University so I could compete with kids on the East Coast, you know, in terms of, you know, getting jobs. It was never a mistake. It was I loved doing it, and then to get to the very top, you know, coach of the year in the NFL. The only other guy that did that before me was Paul Brown. To be talked about with Paul Brown and people like Blanton Kaya, and where I am right now, you know, what I do, I know without question I would have never done anything else except be a teacher and a coach.
What if you were running the Cleveland Browns all the time? Let's go back to when Art Modell fired Paul Brown.
Right.
Good, bad, neutral. Did the Browns survive that? What do you think?
I think
from that point on.
My point is that, two things. I think it was a big mistake because I think it was the best of all the coaches that became great coaches in the NFL. But then Blanton Kaya was right there alongside him. And then it wasn't so bad in the days of Frank Ryan, in the days of Bill Nelson, in the days of Brian Sipe, in the days of Bernie Kosar. And then when he left, you know, Dan, people ask me that question. You know, as I said to you earlier, I'm married to the same woman for 58 years. Okay, it's 20 minutes to 2. I'll be finished here. Let's say I get home at 3 o'clock. And she leaves me a note and says, "We're done." That's how I felt. That's how I felt.
When the Browns left.
When the Browns left. And then we go back to the very first question that you asked me. I think for the first time, it's sad to say that Al Lerner died. And I think Randy Lerner really, it's not going to give you the enthusiasm that Jim Haslam is going to give us now. And so I think Jim Haslam is the light at the end of the tunnel. I think it's, people are going to love this guy because of his involvement and the things he's wanted to do. Now I'm watching to see, you know, how does this season go? And I wish Pat Shermer the best, but how is this season going? Where are we going to be next year as he takes over? And I think, as I said to you before, it's very, very important. Even though he's never coached before in his life, even though he doesn't know the ins and outs of football, but he knows about people. And I think the four-year education with the Pittsburgh Steelers is going to be of immense help to him and the people that he and Joe Banner hire?
You know, we didn't know that the Steelers had a minority owner.
Right.
He owned, what,
12%, I think.
12%,
12%, yeah.
That's a sizable minor partner.
It's enough to have a say. It's enough to, they went there, he and his dad went there and got to know a lot of people and got to know Colbert, the guy that was the personnel guy. And, you know, they've done nothing but, you know, look at us. We picked Kellen Winslow, who was out of football, I think. And they picked, on the 11th round, we picked him on the 8th. On the 11th round, they picked Ben Roethlisberger. Suppose we had Ben Roethlisberger. That's the difference. That's the difference. He's been to 3 Super Bowls, and he's won 2 of them already. That's how important it is to get that person, that quarterback. Look at Brady. Look what Rodgers did after he kind of sat around for 2 or 3 years and with Brett Favre. And look at Peyton Manning, and look at Eli Manning, you know, after a while, and what he's done.
And look at what happened to the Browns for that brief period. I think you were coaching when Paul McDonald replaced Brian Sipe.
Yeah, it probably cost me my job.
Yes, probably did.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
Was that the only time you were ever fired?
Well, I got fired. I got fired as an assistant coach, but never
maybe
got fired.
You let go.
Yeah, never fired as a head coach except for that one time. Yeah. And you know, when I look back on it and I see all the things I did at Liberty, you know, Liberty was 5,000 students. Last year, Dan, Liberty had 80,000 online students.
Really?
Yeah, Jerry. The Baptists don't dance, but Jerry is dancing in heaven right now. I guarantee you. I mean, things are going on. And my son is an associate athletic director. Yeah. One of my daughters graduated from there. One of my granddaughters graduated from there. One of my other granddaughters is going there as we speak right now. Talk to WTAM, Bill. His 2 kids are going there.
Really?
And he loves it.
You've worked for some interesting people. By the way, Jerry Falwell's father was a big baseball fan. He owned the minor league baseball
That's
team
right.
in Lynchburg, Virginia, back in the 50s and 60s.
I used to go watch him play all
Did
the time.
You? Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. You worked for some interesting people. How
right.
about who was the most interesting person you ever worked for? Jerry Falwell. He may be in your top 10. I don't know.
I would say Jerry Falwell. Because of what he stood for and the things that he built and how he was involved in so many different things. He was such an unbelievably talented man. He was a guy that was very, very controversial. But, you know, I knew him and I knew what he stood for. And it meant so much to me and to my family at that time. And I enjoyed 11 seasons and 10 years I was at Liberty as much as I enjoyed any other job.
Okay. Art Modell, certainly an interesting guy. Who are some of the others?
Well, I think Weeb Eubank.
Oh, yeah.
Hank Stram. Hank Stram was a wonderful coach. Lou Saban, who was a great coach at Buffalo and a great coach at Denver, and he was a great player here.
The early days of the AFL.
That's right. That's right. I was with him at Maryland in 1966. Oh, yeah. He decided to take a 10-year contract to go to coach the Denver Broncos. He asked me to go with him, and that year in 1967 was the year of the merger, the AFL and the NFL.
Do you want to blow your nose?
No.
Okay. We can edit that out, can't we? Sure,
yeah,
we can.
Easy.
Okay. Who's your best lifelong friend?
My wife, without question. My wife. Yeah, Barbara's and I have been married for 58 years and have gone through many things. As I said earlier, moved 19 times. Kids went to 23 schools. Bought and sold 13 houses. I mean, come on. She's a saint.
Did she ever get cranky about that? That's a tough life for a woman, Sam.
All the time.
Really?
All the time. But once
Well, then you're the saint. You stuck with her. She was always cranky.
But when we got to the place and she bought the house, it was, and we left, it was always the best place we've ever been.
Really?
So, yeah.
Did she pick out your place at Waite Hill?
I never did for obvious reasons, but we had decided that it reminded us of New England. And we had lived in Connecticut and Boston. Mm-hmm. So we decided to rent a three-bedroom apartment because my son was in college. Two girls were going to go to a private school and met in Willoughby, Ohio. And so we decided to store some of our furniture and let her live here for a year or two and find a place in Wade Hill. So I was going to training camp to Kent State. And Art said, listen, my realtor wants... I said, Art, I don't have time for her to look at a house. He said, just go with her. Just go with her. So I went with Art Modell's friend, and we saw this place about a mile away with 12 acres. And... And I said to Art, I'm going to make a bid. I don't want to embarrass you. He said, don't worry about it. I made a bid and they accepted it. I called my wife on the phone. I said, forget about the store and the furniture. Forget about the apartment. Here's the new address. And she said, oh, my gosh. I can't believe that you made that decision. I know you're never involved in any of that. And she loved it. And she loved it. So even to this day, we look out our dining room and we have, here I am right now. It took me 19 minutes to get downtown Cleveland and I have 12 acres. I couldn't do that in New York. I couldn't do that in Boston.
That had
I couldn't
to be do it in Washington. Over 34 years ago.
Yeah, it was 1978.
Okay.
Yep.
Is the house paid for?
The house is paid for. Amen.
Now, that was not far from where Art Modell lived.
Art Modell lived right up the street. He lived about...
Was that good or bad?
It was good when we won, bad when we lost. Goes right back to dinner.
Oh, gee.
Yeah. Oh, man. But I thought it bought me time. But not so much time as it bought me the one-on-ones that I needed from him. Oh. That, you know, that I thought that sometimes... in an organization, especially now, as large as the organizations are, and people are kind of they're all trying to take care of themselves, and I was able to get to a lot of phone booths with Art Modell and tell him things, and he listened to me.
Were you? He had his circle of advisors.
Oh yeah.
That did not make things any easier.
No, it didn't. You know, it's kind of like, you know, Peter Hadasy said, Brian Sipe can't play.
He did?
Yeah, Art Modell told me that Brian Sipe couldn't play. And I talked to Fran Tarkenton, I talked to Bob Greasy, and I talked to Len Dawson, similar type quarterbacks. Every one of them said the same thing. Said, Sam, the guy is accurate. That's the key to quarterbacks. You know, percentage completions. And he has that indefinable poise in the huddle. You know, what we called it was Brian Sipe saw the defense in slow motion. Some other young quarterbacks see the defense like Times Square on New Year's Eve. It's a big difference. And I think that helped me a lot. Helped me a lot.
Now, Chuck Eaton always took pride in saying, when I saw this kid, Brian Sipe, on the practice field, nobody else noticed him. He said, I thought that I was looking at a future great quarterback here. Well, and that was the only other guy who thought he was any good, you and Chuck Eaton.
Well, yeah, Chuck Eaton was a good guy. You know, he was around some of Blanton Collier's picks. Mm-hmm. He was around some of Paul Brown's picks.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a great man.
Yes.
Loved him.
However... When you became the head coach here in 1978, was Mike Phipps gone?
Yeah,
we traded
Mike Phipps for number one and picked Ozzie Newsome.
Really?
Yeah, we picked Clay Matthews, who played 19 years, and then we picked Ozzie Newsome 22nd or 23rd.
With the draft pick you acquired from the Bears.
Yep.
Really?
That's
well,
right.
Then that trade for Paul Warfield, actually, we sold from that.
It ended up fine. It was a lot of pain while it was going on, but it ended up great. Really, I think Clay Matthews is Ozzie's already there, but I think Clay Matthews is a sure bet. 19 years, three-down linebacker in the Hall of Fame.
He said to me once that he loved practice. I said, what? Most players, they hate practice. He said, I love practice. How many players did you know who loved practice?
That's the first one I've ever heard.
Really?
The one you just told me, Clay. Oh, he's a great, great young man, has a great family, great wife. Leslie has four or five kids, and they're all doing well. Not surprised.
Okay, I asked you who were your best friend and who were you the best player and all this. Would you say, is there anybody that you really did not like?
Oh, boy. I don't think there was anybody I really didn't like. There were some people I wouldn't choose to spend some time with. But as I said to you earlier, one of the things that was I'm repeating myself, but, you know, I'm very good at selective amnesia. My wife is not. Women are different.
She carries a grudge.
Oh, yeah. She doesn't carry a grudge so much because I told her, you know, that, you know, the Bible's full of the word forgiven. She said, well, I also know that the Bible says you can forgive and you can forget. And you don't have to forget, rather. I said, oh, yeah, right. But I'm really good at that. I blank it out. As a matter of fact, you know, in the days of not having whiteout, everybody was in my address book in pencil. So the moment that I dislike somebody, I just erase them.
No.
That didn't bother me.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Then you had your list.
Oh, yeah, I had my list. Yeah, sure.
But maybe you don't remember who was on your list.
No, I refuse to say.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, not just it would be against the things that I believe in.
Yes. What's the best thing about Cleveland that you like?
People. Best, you know, I was in a job that everybody cherishes the Cleveland Browns because of Paul Brown, because of Blanton Kaya, because of the great players like Grozer and Dick Ambrose and his wife Mary Beth still go out with Joey Lavelli for dinner because of all those things, and then to be the head coach of the Cleveland Browns and have a chance to live here, for, you know, and it's going to be a lifetime. It's going to be a lifetime.
Yes.
I already have, in Wade Hill, two plots for my wife and I. Yep. I'm not interested in going there, but that's. But I will someday.
Really?
But it's going to be in Wade Hill.
Huh.
Yeah.
Now, is this in one of your acres, or is this in a cemetery?
Cemetery out there. Yeah.
What's the cemetery?
It's the Wade Hill Cemetery.
Wade Hill Cemetery. Yep. You're going to be there someday.
Right. Yep.
Welcome home.
There's only going to be a body there. I'm going to be hopefully in heaven.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What was you claimed that you never read the papers?
I did. I really didn't. I can say that honestly. My wife can prove it.
You were such an icon here in Cleveland that because you had the long name, it wouldn't fit in a headline.
Right.
So they could use big type and just was Sam this and Sam that.
Right.
For what, 7 years? It was Sam.
And in some cases, it still is. And do you remember, Dan, that the day that I got fired, I spoke to you?
Yes.
At Friendly's?
I remember that.
In the morning.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you are, and I refuse to allow you to explain yourself on that because you always said, I want to tell you something about why I couldn't. And I knew! I knew you couldn't. We were doing this little radio thing
back then.
On WHK.
That's great.
And I would interview you every Monday morning.
Right, exactly.
And that Monday morning, you would meet with the coaches at Friendly's in Berea.
Yeah.
And you did it as just like every Monday. Now, was that a surprise to you? You got fired, what, the night before?
Night before, yeah.
Was that a surprise? Did you sense something might be
Art called at 9 o'clock and said he wanted to see me, and I said to Barbara, well, I'm going to get fired. She said, no. He didn't fly back with the team. He just said, yeah. I said, sure. And he doesn't want me to bring a pizza to his house either. So he said the same thing to me that he said to Paul Brown.
And what was that?
And that was, this is the most difficult thing I've ever done in my life. Paul Brown wrote to me. He said, I read that in your book. It's exactly the exact same thing he said to me. And as I said to you earlier, I said, well, I take that as a tremendous privilege to be on the anywhere with you.
Anyway, that Monday morning, we do the radio thing,
right,
just like we had always done it every Monday morning.
Yeah.
Not a hint from you, because you were sitting there then telling your coaches, I've been fired.
Right, yeah.
And then they all had
right
to think,
that.
You know, is he going to wipe out everybody? And,
yeah.
And was Marty Schottenheimer with you at that meeting with the coaches?
No, yeah, Marty was there. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So now you're saying Marty's going to be named the head coach in a couple hours.
Right.
So, of course, you had to protect the release date on your firing, so you had to fake it that morning. And I know that you had to be so uncomfortable doing that.
Oh, it was very uncomfortable.
Yes, yes. Sure. And I can understand completely what you were going through.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh. I'll say one thing, Sam. Of all the coaches that I covered, nobody was more fun to deal with than you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate
yes,
that.
Yes, and I'm sure that everybody in this
likewise
town can say the same.
Right. Thank
will
you
say the same thing.
Yeah.
Out of all of them, I had a great friend in baseball, Jeff Torborg. Always a good, also a good guy like you.
I liked Jeff very much.
And
got to know him.
Yes. So, but anyway, you were the most fun to cover.
Well, thank
Sam
you.
Sam would walk into a room, and it would light up with X's and O's.
Oh, thank you, Dan.
Well,
my
you're
pleasure.
So, yeah. And I'm...
Thanks for this opportunity, too, and to the library and all the people that are here. It's a wonderful
okay,
privilege.
Okay, is there a...
I think you covered it all.
Anything else that you want to say to future generations here in, Cleveland?
No, I just pray that next Tuesday, without going into anything, we do what's best for this country, and most of all for yours and my grandchildren.
Okay, since you say that, by the way, back then, people said you could run for mayor. You could run for governor. Yes. And mm-hmm. And you know, I do believe.
Oh.
If you'd have said, yes, I'm going to run for mayor in 1980, you would have been elected. Yes.
I don't know about
it. But anyway, Sam, thank you.
I enjoyed it very much. I enjoyed it. Everything that this place stands for, the Cleveland Public Library, and wonderful people I had lunch with today. Thank you.
Well, thanks. You've been a great friend, and I've admired you all these decades. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah. And good luck in that final game.
Ha 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 ha.